Welcome to the Science Podcast for September 7th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. This week, a rare but potentially treatable form of autism, Asia's burgeoning research institutions, and some insight into the role of regulatory DNA.
Recently, genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, have been able to tell us where some of the variation involved in human diseases and traits lies in the genome.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
Studies that compare the genomes of individuals are designed to pick up even slight variations that lead to different phenotypes, including illness. Matthew Murano and colleagues looked for single nucleotide changes in the non-coding regulatory regions in hundreds of genomes. These regulatory regions, which control the expression of different genes, provide a rich hunting ground for disease-related variation. Sarah Crespi spoke with Murano about how tracking down these subtleties can lead to a better understanding of complex health problems.
Biologists have known for a long time that the regulation of gene expression is very important in the determination of traits and phenotypes. Though proteins are the fundamental building blocks of the cell, people noticed early on that they're actually 99% identical between humans and chimpanzees. Their reasoning at that time was that the key to the differences then between the two species must lie in where and when those proteins are actually expressed. More recently, genome-wide association studies, or GWAS, have been able to tell us where some of the variation involved in human diseases and traits lies in the genome. We used a technique called DNase-1 mapping to map the regulatory regions in the genome in a number of cell types. And what we find is that trait and disease-associated variants are concentrated in regulatory DNA. And what's more, they're concentrated in the regulatory DNA specific to particular cell types. And our overall point is to start thinking of human genetics in terms of its effect on gene expression regulation.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit more about these GWAS. What kinds of information do these studies tell us, and how do they work?
Well, the sequencing of the human genome enabled a very extensive survey of all the ways that genomes differ between different individuals. This led to the development of genotyping tips that were focused on a particular type of sequence difference called the single nucleotide polymorphism, so just a single base pair difference between individuals.
Mm-hmm.
And these tips were very good at economically measuring hundreds of thousands of variants in the genetic sequence. And this was done with partly having the idea that this would enable kind of a genetic study in humans called an association study. So you use these chips to genotype DNA samples from several thousand people who have a particular disease or trait and several thousand controls who don't. And if you consistently find a particular genetic variant in the people who have the disease more often than the ones who don't, that's evidence for its association with that particular disease. With these genotyping chips, you can do this on a scale throughout the genome on thousands of people. It was just unthinkable before. And over the last 7 or 8 years, the community has applied this technique to hundreds of diseases and traits. The amazing thing is we now have thousands of loci that are associated with real human diseases and traits. There's been a bit of a disappointment because most of these variants increase the probability of having a disease only slightly,
mm-hmm.
and so they're not very good as diagnostics on their own. But on the other hand, kind of in the sense that where there's smoke, there's fire, even a small association gives you an insight into the mechanism that you never thought of before.
Right. And so these variations that you see in people with disease, they can be in a coding region of the gene or in a non-coding or regulatory region. And you focused on those regions. How did you pick those out specifically?
Well, what's interesting is actually most of the variants that have been associated with these diseases are not actually in coding sequence, about 95% of them. And picking out what part of the genome is regulatory is actually a bit difficult. 99% of the genome doesn't actually code for protein, but only a small fraction of that is directly involved in the regulation of gene expression. So the technique I mentioned earlier called DNase-1 mapping takes advantage of this classical technique, which uses accessibility to an endonuclease. So basically you have this little enzyme that goes in there, and for some reason the DNA is uncompacted, it's accessible. It can get cleaved, and we can measure that. And this has been shown to be a marker for all sorts of variety of regulatory elements. This allows you, with high-throughput sequencing, to map the regulatory regions of genomes, different cell types, genome-wide.
So you were able to take advantage of the fact that there's a different structure of the DNA, at this large scale surrounding these regions involved in regulation.
Exactly. When part of the genome is not being involved in regulation, the chromatin is very highly compacted, inaccessible cleavage, whereas the regions that are active regulatory regions are inaccessible chromatin, which is what the DNA assay finds.
And what about the variation in these regions? How does it compare with the rest of the genome?
So I mentioned that a small part of the genome, about 1% of the genome, actually codes for proteins. So about 5% of the associations in humans that people have found are actually encoding regions. So you can see that that's a huge enrichment relative to its size. But because only 1% of the genome codes for protein, there's actually a huge amount of variations in non-coding regions. And so the types of variation you would find in coding genes that are making actual amino acid changes or truncations of proteins, you would expect to have a fairly large effect size, because if you truncate a protein very early on, it just plain doesn't work.
Right.
Whereas the types of variation you would expect to see in regulatory DNA, you expect to have somewhat of a smaller effect size. Regulatory regions are composed of multiple transcription factor binding sites. And if you perturb one of them, you may simply change which cell types, the spread of cell types in which a particular gene is expressed, or the timing. So it's a little bit more of a subtle change.
Mm-hmm. And how did looking at the profiles of different cell types help refine your results?
So we took advantage of a catalog of genome-wide association studies that's been compiled very nicely by the National Human Genome Research Institute, and they covered a spread of several hundred diseases and traits, so we can look for an enrichment in genetic variation in a wide spectrum of disease. So we see global enrichment of all these variants overall without thinking of disease, but we also see enrichments for particular diseases. We can break it down by cell type because, as I mentioned, we know the regulatory regions in a number of different cell types, and they're actually not the same. If you look at a different cell type, the DNA that's involved, the regulation that's active, is very different than what you would find from a different cell type. You can look at the context of a genetic variant in terms of which cell types have active regulatory DNA at that site. And you can see that, for example, maybe a SNP that's associated, a polymorphism associated with prostate cancer, might be in a region that's active regulatory DNA, that's DNase-1 hypersensitive in, for example, prostate cancer cell line, but not in other cell types.
So you saw an association between, you know, this variability and a regulatory region that tends to be active in a certain cell type and a disease that is also active in that cell type.
Yes.
You also looked at variation during different developmental time points. What did that tell you?
So we had a number of samples of developmental origin, and we were interested in this because there's long been evidence for the influence of a number of early gestational exposures on later disease development and phenotypes. And so we tend to think of development, at least in terms of gene expression regulation, as this progressive compaction of the chromatin landscape. So you start out with embryonic stem cells being pluripotent, and as they differentiate down the landscape, they choose which lineage they're going to go into and eventually which particular cell type, and a number of options are closed off to them. This reflects itself in the differences in the regulatory landscapes that we've measured in the different cell types. And so we can take a look, as I mentioned, across a number of different diseases, and we can ask for the disease-associated variants. What proportion of them, proportion of the variation, is in regulatory elements that were originally active during the fetal stage, rather than which came activated later and are not found in any sort of developmental cell type that we've surveyed?
So what would it mean if the regulatory region with a variation in it was active during development?
This means that the chromatin is uncompacted. There's a transcription factor binding there during gestation. And the idea is that the chromatin landscape has been shown to be exquisitely sensitive to perturbation by outside factors, glucocorticoids, other influences. And if you have an active regulatory element at that site, it may be responsive to some stimulus during the pregnancy. It may be able to provide a mechanism for how that stimulus could be remembered throughout adulthood and therefore lead to an adult disease which was dependent upon an exposure during gestation. Interestingly, the diseases and traits that we see enriched in having variation at these originally fetal regulatory elements are traits like cardiovascular disease, body mass index, or weight, menarche. So these are growth and developmental related phenotypes versus the ones we see are depleted or things that are more like aging, cancer, and inflammatory diseases. You could think of these as potentially being more responsive to an outside stimulus later on in adulthood.
Really interesting. So kind of getting more to a general question here, how do these results improve our ability to understand and treat disease?
Well, so thinking about human health and the development of new treatments or pharmaceutical treatments, I think one of the recurring themes has been the difficulty of applying model systems to what actually happens in human health. When you're doing an association study like this, you're dealing with real people, healthy, or they've had a disease through a natural progression of a disease. You're getting genetic variation that is relevant to the real world. Now, the sort of trade-off with genetics, you know, genetics started before we even knew what a gene was, and so it doesn't give you very much context for what the associations mean, you know, that both its power and its weakness. What we have in this study is we make the proposal that you can look at a lot of this variation in terms of its effect on gene expression regulation, And we have very high throughput techniques that are amenable to the numbers of, we're talking about thousands of variants here. So you want to be able to deal with these in a reasonable manner. And then take a lot of this variation, which, as I mentioned, most of the variations that have been found in these genome-wide association studies have relatively low effect sizes, and you can't really make a diagnostic, for example, for genetic susceptibility based on a couple of these variants.
Mm-hmm.
But if you can look at it in terms of how they affect gene expression regulation, we're able to find that different diseases which are related have perturbations in the same transcription factor. And you wouldn't know that if you hadn't been thinking about these variations in terms of their effect on gene expression regulation.
Hmm. Well, Matt Murano, thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Matthew Murano and colleagues write about gene regulation and disease in this week's Science.
An editorial this week by Science Editor-in-Chief Bruce Alberts and Science Careers Editor James Austin discusses a new tool for science career planning called MyIDP. Science's Meghna Sachdev spoke with Austin about using this tool to chart career goals. Here's a preview of their discussion.
One problem that we face in science right now is that there is a widespread expectation on the part of science trainees that they will end up doing what their faculty advisors do, what their mentors do. And, of course, those people are always in academia. But it's well established and widely known at this point that there are far more trainees than there are positions in academia. That's okay if there is other good and productive work that those people can end up doing. So one of the most important things that MyIDP achieves is broadening the expectations about what kinds of careers people might choose.
You can read the editorial and hear the whole podcast in this week's issue of Science at www.sciencemag.org.
Autism spectrum disorders are a collection of syndromes that commonly lead to impairments in social interaction. While autism appears to be heritable in many cases, the key genes involved have remained unknown. However, individuals with a specific heritable type of autism provide a unique avenue to investigate the genetics behind this syndrome. Gaia Novarino and colleagues sequenced the genes of families with an inherited form of autism and discovered mutations in the BCKDK gene. Knocking out BCKDK in mouse models creates symptoms similar to those of autism, which suggests that this form of the disorder is due to an imbalance in branched-chain amino acids in the brain. I spoke with Novarino from her office in San Diego, where she began by describing autism spectrum disorders.
Autism spectrum disorders is a group of complex neurological disorders that cause problems in sociability, in verbal and nonverbal communication, and repetitive behaviors. So the term spectrum refers to the wide range of symptoms and levels of impairment that children with autism spectrum disorder can have. So some children are mildly impaired by their symptoms, but others instead are very severely disabled.
So in your paper, you focused on a specific type of autism. You looked at individuals with autism that also suffered from epilepsy. So how did you go about studying this form of the disease?
So it is estimated that approximately a quarter of individuals that have autism have also epilepsy. Our group and a group in Yale recruited two families in which the parents were first cousins. And the children have autism and epilepsy. So this suggests that both the parents might be the carrier for a genetic mutation. So we decided to sequence the entire exome, so the entire exome of the affected children, and we identified in the two families independently mutation in the BCKDK gene.
So you identified this mutation. Why did you think that this certain mutation was linked to autism?
So we thought that this type of autism was maybe linked with specific mutation, or that autism with epilepsy will be linked with some genetic mutation, because we have seen many families in which the parents have multiple children affected by autism and epilepsy. While it's very difficult to find example of classical autism alone, so that was giving us the idea that probably the forms of autism presenting with epilepsy might have a more simple genetic explanation as opposed to complex mode of inheritance, maybe, of the classical autism. And again, so as I mentioned, those are special families. So the parents are related by blood, and they have more than one child affected by the disorder. So those pedigrees with consanguineous parents are excellent model of inherited disorders. So some of those families have many children, and the disorder is clearly an autosomal recessive.
Could you talk a little bit about the mutations that you found within the exomes of these families?
So in the first family that we analyzed, we found so-called nonsense mutation. That means that there is a codon that instead coding for an amino acid as it's supposed to do is coding for a stop. So basically this would lead the mRNA would be translated to a completely truncated protein. That's mutation suddenly in the middle of the protein, so probably the protein wasn't going to be functional. But what we found was even more interesting. The mRNA is not stable, so it's not translated at all, so we don't find any protein. And the second family, we found more or less a similar case. So we have, in that case, a frame shift that also leads to a premature stop codon. So we also that we don't have mRNA and we don't have protein.
So these mutations are disrupting the coding genes of the DNA. And one gene that you particularly focused on in the study was this BCKDK gene. So is there much known about this BCKDK gene before the work in your study?
So actually, there was not a lot about this specific gene. So what we knew before, it was that the protein that is coded by this gene is mediating the inactivation of a protein complex that is called BCKD8. And this complex is important for the breakdown, for the metabolism of three special amino acids that are called branched chain amino acids. And those are essential amino acids, so we cannot produce them in our body. So we need to take them in the food by our diet.
Mm-hmm.
So what we knew is this BCKDH complex, part of this complex, are mutated in another disorder that is called maple syrup urine disorder. And what we have found now is basically the mirror disorder of the maple syrup urine disorder. The mechanism probably is completely different, but what BCKDA does is to inactivate the BCKDH complex. And so when BCKDK is not present, the protein is not there, the BCKDH complex cannot be switched off.
So it looks like you have a good case to suggest that the BCKDK gene is causing the problem in these autistic individuals. So you have a gene that is linked to heritable cases of epilepsy and is similar to this other gene, BCKDH, for another disease that causes maple syrup urine. So how did you go about testing whether BCKDK gene was responsible for what you were seeing in these families?
So I think that the key part was to study the BCKDK knockout mouse. And indeed, so mice that lack BCKDK, this condition that is very similar to our patient.
So what were the effects when you knocked out the BCKDK gene in mice?
So they have very severe neurological phenotypes. So for instance, if you take a knockout animal by the tail, the hind limbs are entirely retracted and touch the abdomen, while in the wild type, they would play outward. And so this is a well-known neurological phenotype observed also in other autism mouse models. And in addition, they also have epileptic seizures, so as our patients. And we also observe some sociability abnormalities, but we need to test them in more details, really, too, in order to be sure about that.
So beyond neurological behavioral differences, did you find any metabolic changes going on inside these mice?
So what we find that is very interesting is that because they cannot switch off this BCKDH complex and therefore the catabolic pathway of those three amino acids or branched chain amino acids, they are constantly degrading them or break them down. And so the levels of those three amino acids, they are extremely low in the plasma of our patients and in the mice. So that's very interesting because this is basically a biomarker. So in a field where a biomarker is almost impossible to have, to be able to take plasma from patients and test whether they could in principle have this mutation. So this was the first thing, but the fact that they don't have those branched chain amino acids in the plasma also leads to the consequence that they don't have them also in their brain. And so that's maybe part of the cause of the neurological phenotype.
Okay, so there's certain types of amino acids that aren't at the concentration that you would expect in the blood or even in the brain. So is there any way to treat this deficiency?
Yes, we think that there is, and actually very simple. So it would be to supplement those amino acids in the diet of the patients. So that's what we did with our knockout animals.
So pretty much what you're saying is that just by feeding these mice more of this certain type of amino acid, you could rescue it from the problems associated with this version of the gene.
Yes, that's correct. So when we supplement the diet of those animals with these amino acids, we were able to rescue all the neurological phenotypes that we have looked at.
So how does this relate to the disorder in humans? Do you think doctors will someday recommend people take this supplement?
So I think that the mouse recapitulates the human disorder, and I therefore believe that patients with mutation in BCKDK could be treated by diet supplementation. But as I say, so patient with this mutation is not a general cure for autism.
So what are your next steps in the research of how this gene mutation is linked to autism?
So one first step for sure is to search more patients with mutations in this gene.
Mm-hmm.
And probably then I would like to definitely to correct better the behavior of phenotypes of the knockout animals and see whether we can rescue all of them or just some of them with diet supplementation. But for me, it's maybe the most important thing is to really understand the exact mechanism that the deficiency in these three branched chain amino acids leads to disorder, so which is the real mechanism.
Mm-hmm. So in the beginning, we talked about what constitutes autism. Do you think that all of these forms of autism are amenable to this type of treatment or prevention?
I think that what we found is a very special case. So probably not all the forms of autism are amenable to treatment and prevention, at least not right now. Many other groups are working on autism, and the picture that is coming out is very complex, and each form of autism may be different.
Gaia Novarino, thanks for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Gaia Novarino and colleagues described the mechanism and possible treatment for a heritable form of autism this week in Science.
The United States is home to most of the world's top research universities, but many countries are now trying to emulate the path that the U.S. followed in hopes of growing their own academic powerhouses. This week, Science kicks off a series that examines the key ingredients in creating and maintaining these so-called global research universities. In this first story, Dennis Normile explores the role of mobility by focusing on the increasing flow of talent into East Asia, in particular Hong Kong and Singapore. He spoke with me about this reverse brain drain from Tokyo.
The countries of East Asia, especially those with Confucian traditions, have always revered scholarship and learning. And in recent years, despite the most recent economic difficulties, these countries have become wealthy enough to invest in their universities. Greater numbers of students are going on for tertiary education and even advanced degrees. And these countries and regions want a few flagship institutions to be in the ranks of elite global universities. And so as National University of Singapore President Tan Chor Chuan told me, to achieve academic excellence, attracting, nurturing, and retaining top talent is the most vital strategy. So these schools are joining the international competition for top academic talent.
And to do that, they're bringing in scientists from all over the world.
Exactly. They're recruiting all over the world.
So you mentioned the National University of Singapore. What other schools are we talking about?
In Singapore, it's the National University of Singapore and then Nanyang Technological University. And in Hong Kong, in particular, there's the University of Hong Kong and the Hong Kong University of Science and Technology. I should say that schools throughout Asia are all moving in this direction, but it's schools in Hong Kong and Singapore that have led the way.
So does this represent a shift, you know, something new? Are there more foreign-born scientists moving to these institutions than in the past?
Well, I think the numbers are certainly increasing. The schools in Hong Kong and Singapore have had a head start, but there is increasing interest among universities in China. For one thing, the universities are expanding, they're growing very quickly. They want to be players at an international level. And so they are increasingly recruiting non-Chinese to fill positions. that started with positions, particularly in China, I'm talking about in business schools, but now they have a program specifically intended to attract scientists and engineers, and not just to their universities, but to high-tech companies as well.
So what is it exactly that's, you know, attracting, actually drawing these scientists in from around the world?
It's plain and simple opportunity. Academic positions in the U.S. and Europe are a bit hard to come by these days, but the universities in Asia, funding is still growing because their student populations are growing. The universities are expanding, so there are new positions opening up, new institutes. Departments are expanding. As Colonel Lemke, a German earth scientist, told me, the positions available in Europe are typically to fill slots being vacated by retiring professors. So if you move into a slot like that, you're basically replacing an established piece of a puzzle, so to speak.
And then in comparison, these positions in Asia aren't necessarily just replacements or stepping stones. They're actually more career-oriented and prestigious positions. Is that right?
For sure. The universities in Asia, particularly those in Hong Kong and Singapore, do not think of these as stepping stone positions. They are looking for people who will stay and build careers. Of course, they expect that some people will leave, you know, move on to other positions, but they really don't want somebody who's just going to come for a couple of years and then leave. They want people that will build careers here.
So do these opportunities tend to be attracting younger or older scientists?
Both. They are looking for senior scientists to fill leadership positions. And at the same time, they're looking for younger researchers whose careers are just taking off. One example of the former is Kerry See. He is a prominent geologist who had a tenured position at California Institute of Technology in Pasadena. He's now 60 or 61, I forget exactly. He gave up that comfortable position at a prestigious university to be the founding director of the Earth Observatory of Singapore at Nanyang Technological University. And this is a generously funded center of excellence that is getting something like $127 million over 10 years. And they expect it to become a center that will have 50 or 60 top academics that will do groundbreaking research in earth sciences and climate change.
Wow.
And at the other end of the career path, another example is Stephanie Wenner. She's a German quantum information scientist who came to Singapore for her very first faculty position after completing a postdoc stint in the U.S.
Now, what about the non-career aspects of a move like this? You know, attractive positions and the global economic situation might be drawing foreign scientists over to Hong Kong and Singapore. But as you said, some have given up well-established careers. Some of them, I'm sure, have families. Can you speak to the quality of life that seems to be keeping these scientists in these places?
Well, I think for most academics, the opportunities for research and teaching is the main draw. The lifestyle, of course, is a very important thing. Here again, Hong Kong and Singapore, because of their colonial legacies, have a big advantage in that they have been, for a long time, the most cosmopolitan cities in Asia. And so, you know, just about anybody from any country can move there and feel at home. There are also, in both cities, very high-quality and well-respected international schools for children.
So on a global scale, what's the bigger picture here? Do you think that this is going to result in a shift of strength from today's academic powerhouses, or is this simply going to help level the playing field for Asian institutions?
It's definitely more a matter of leveling the playing field. The governments in the region want a few flagship schools to be among the world's best research universities. Their thrust is not to try to set up a competition between East and West. They're really trying to achieve academic excellence. And they see academic excellence as necessitating recruiting the best academics, no matter where they come from.
Great. Well, Dennis Normile, thank you so much.
Okay.
Contributing correspondent Dennis Normile talks about East Asia's global research universities in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, we have Meghna Sachdev, online news writer for Science. She's here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi. Okay, Meghna, first up, we have a story about the tragic lives of the bold, in this case, bold elk.
Yes. So a new study has discovered that the boldest elk are the ones that often end up getting targeted by hunters, and the shy ones get away.
So how do they study bold and shy elk behavior?
Shy elk tend to avoid areas that are populated by humans, and they don't explore very much. And so the bold elk are basically encountering people a little more and tend to be a lot more exploratory.
So that's how they define the personalities of these elk. How did they study their interactions with hunters?
So about 122 elk were tracked with GPS collars, and their movements were analyzed. And at the end of the hunting season, researchers looked at how the elk were moving and how many of them had been killed. And it turned out about 25 of them died by the end of hunting season.
And those were the bold?
Most of them were the bold ones. What they found was that the elk that move the most and travel the biggest distances tend to be the ones that were killed by hunters.
And so what does this say about elk populations and their interactions with people?
Well, one of the things that researchers are concerned about is that the humans are acting as a selective pressure in elk populations. So essentially, by selecting for the bold elk, humans might be making elk populations a little bit more skittish.
And so what about other predators that like to eat elk? Are they pushing them in the same direction?
Well, that's actually the next step, and that's what researchers want to study. Are the bold elk also targeted by predators like wolves and bears? And one of the things they think might be happening is that maybe the bold elk actually managed to get away from these natural predators, and so everything might balance out in the end.
Interesting. Okay, well, next up, we have another animal story. This time, it's tiger timeshares, a story about how these endangered and dangerous animals are learning to live with humans.
Yes, that's right. A field study in Nepal's Chitwan National Park looked at how tigers and people can share the same environment. And what they found is that tigers are adapting by becoming a little bit more nocturnal.
So why did the researchers choose to look at Nepal for the study?
Well, so Nepal's Chitwan National Park is one of the less than 30 parks in the world that can support enough breeding tigers to maintain genetic diversity. And it's also got a lot of human interaction and human activity in the area.
So there's more people there, but how do they study tigers when there weren't people around?
So what they did is they set up about 75 camera traps in the dry season over 2 years. They put them around roads and other areas where they expected tigers and people to be, and they just sort of looked to see how many tigers and how many people they could catch.
And so what they found was that the tigers and the people were not overlapping.
What they expected to find was that human activity would be driving the tigers further into the park, but that's not actually what they found. The density of the tiger populations well into the park and around these more active areas was about the same.
So how is this different from what we already knew about tiger behavior?
Tigers in parts of the world like Indonesia and Malaysia, which have been studied, are seen about half the time in the daylight. But what they saw in Nepal was that between 80 and 95% of their activity was done in the dark. So the tigers don't really like hanging out with people. And so they decided the best way to share the space was by becoming a little bit more nocturnal.
So tigers are behaving this way in Nepal, but are we going to see similar kinds of stratification of time between people and animals in other countries and other places?
Well, researchers say that this is something that does need to be included in conservation plans. But one of the reasons this works in Nepal is because there is an economic incentive. There's a lot of ecotourism, so it is supporting the population and stopping the people from getting cranky when it comes to sharing their space with tigers. But I don't think we can expect to see us running timeshares with bears or wolves anytime soon.
Okay, last up, we have a story on how the shape of a glass could actually influence how much we imbibe.
Yes, so next time you drink too much, you really might be able to blame your glass. Researchers were interested to see whether there was an optical illusion going on when people drank beer out of fluted versus straight glasses. People tend to pace themselves when they drink beer as opposed to drinking soft drinks like Coke or lemonade, but they weren't finding that happening with fluted glasses, so they took a look into it.
So how did they convince people to drink beer for science?
Well, surprisingly, it wasn't that hard to do. What they did is they had a few groups of people drink beer and lemonade out of two different kinds of glasses while watching a nature documentary, so they weren't just sitting around drinking. And then they measured how fast each of the groups finished their drinks.
And so the fluted glasses had an effect?
They did when it came to beer. People tend to pace themselves when it comes to beer. And so what they found was that when people were drinking out of straight glasses, they tended to drink slower. I think it took them about 13 minutes to finish what was about 354 milliliters, which is about a regular can of beer. Whereas when they were drinking out of fluted glasses, they finished in about 8 minutes. And that's about as fast as they were drinking the lemonade as well.
And so what's going on there? Why did the fluted glass make a difference?
What they think is happening is that there's an optical illusion with the fluted glass. So it's a lot more difficult to figure out when you get to the halfway point. So one of the things researchers in the UK, where the study was done, are interested in doing is figuring out how to get people to control their drinking. And so they found that people do want to know how much they're drinking, and they tend to self-regulate by looking at when they get halfway. And if they can't do that with the fluted glasses, they tend to just drink it all down.
So what are the next steps? Are they going to start marking up glasses in pubs?
Actually, that's exactly one of the solutions they came up with. I guess we'll see if it works.
We'll know when the glass is half empty. Okay, Meghna, well, what else is on the site this week?
Well, on Science Now this week, you can find out about the International ENCODE Project, smooth ocean surfaces during extreme hurricanes, as well as how albatrosses soar. And on our policy blog, Science Insider, you can get the skinny on exactly what the Democratic National Committee's 2012 platform is saying about science and technology. Check out all this and more on our website, news.sciencemag.org.
Meghna Sachdev is a writer for Science News Online. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics every Thursday at 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern Time.
And that concludes the September 7th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Edward Hermy. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.